While Byrd's fire and brimstone act has led liberals to dub the West Virginia senator the conscience of the Senate, the man does have one mighty colorful and checkered past, and that's putting it generously. As a younger man, not only was he a member in good standing of the Ku Klux Klan, but he was such a good member that he got promoted to Kliegel, and in that capacity, Robert Byrd was in charge of recruiting other bigots into the organization, a very important job indeed. After all, not everybody gets to be a Kliegel, only the ones with those very special leadership skills, the kind that might convince some pathetic yahoo to put on a white sheet and a pointy hat. Years later, he explained that he had joined because the Klan offered excitement and was an effective force in promoting traditional American values, and described it as a mistake of youth. Fair enough, we all make mistakes, although I could be wrong about this. Most of us never joined the Ku Klux Klan, either for excitement or because it was a good way to pursue traditional American values, or for any other reason. And besides, Byrd left the Klan a long, long time ago, way back in 1943 when he was about 25. But then in 1971, a letter came to light that Byrd wrote to the Klan's imperial wizard 3 years after he left the KKK. Byrd identifies himself as a former Kliegel and says, "The Klan is needed today as never before, and I am anxious to see its rebirth here in West Virginia. It is necessary that the order be promoted immediately and in every state in the Union. Will you please inform me as to the possibilities of rebuilding the Klan realm of West Virginia?" Nor did Byrd change his tune all that much after his 1958 election to the United States Senate, where he became one of the most adamant members of the Democratic bloc who fought long and hard against civil rights legislation. He personally filibustered more than 14 hours trying to defeat the historic 1964 Civil Rights Act. And he holds the dubious distinction of being the only senator to vote against the only two black Supreme Court nominees in U.S. history, Thurgood Marshall and Clarence Thomas. No one in his party, of course, is going to fault him for going against Thomas, or anything else for that matter. They've certainly never held his sordid past against him. Instead, they've honored him with the posts of Majority Whip and Majority Leader, and as recently as 2001, when he twice used the term white niggers in a TV interview, he got a free pass from all those, both in the public sphere and the media, who normally eviscerate any public figure who displays even a hint of racial insensitivity. Remember Trent Lott? Little wonder, then, that his liberal friends also don't seem to care that the conscience of the Senate has so ruthlessly abused his powerful position on the Senate Appropriations Committee by steering so much taxpayer money to his home state that the nonpartisan Citizens Against Government Waste has crowned him the King of Pork. That group points out that, incredibly, in 2001, Byrd managed to claw $232 million in pork for West Virginia, or $128 for every single resident. As Byrd himself boasts in that charmingly folksy way of his, West Virginia has always had four friends: God Almighty, Sears Roebuck, Carter's Little Liver Pills, and Robert C. Byrd. Think that tells you all you need to know about his ego? Think again. Byrd has almost 30 taxpayer-funded projects named after him in his home state, from the Robert C. Byrd Locks and Dam to the Robert C. Byrd Federal Building. Oh yeah, there's one more thing. Something the Committee Against Government Waste calls a new standard for taxpayer-funded narcissism. It seems that there's a statue of Robert C. Byrd himself in the state capitol, which just happens to violate state law prohibiting statues of government officials until they have been dead for half a century. "Truth has a way of asserting itself despite all attempts to obscure it," proclaimed Byrd in one of his patented Senate harangues. "Distortion only serves to derail it for a time, no matter to what lengths we humans may go to obfuscate facts or delude our fellows. Truth has a way of squeezing out through the cracks eventually." Maybe they could inscribe that on the Robert C. Byrd statue at the state capitol, or the Robert C. Byrd Federal Building, or the Robert C. Byrd Community Center, or the Robert C. Byrd Hilltop Office Complex, or maybe the yet-to-be-built, but don't bet it won't, Robert C. Byrd King of Pork Museum. 47. Maxine Waters. Back in 1992, in the midst of one of the nasty race-based disputes that have marked her career, one of California Representative Maxine Waters' political opponents was reported to have described her, in a private conversation, by using a familiar word that rhymes with witch. Hearing of this, Miss Waters professed to be shocked, shocked, and of course demanded the man's professional head on a platter. After all, as a National Review online columnist wrote at the time, who wouldn't be aghast that a woman of such grace, such refinement, such unparalleled gentility should be spoken of in such terms? Yes, the columnist was kidding. In fact, as anyone who's ever seen her in action will tell you, Maxine Waters is about as refined and genteel as a pit bull in a bad mood, and quick to contaminate the public discourse with her big, belligerent mouth. At times, she even embarrasses her fellow race baiters, which isn't that easy, praising dictators like Fidel Castro while referring to the Republican Party as the enemy, savaging a moderate Republican like former L.A. Mayor Richard Reardon as a fellow plantation owner, and rushing to bully any fellow Democrats who threaten to think independently on race. And when her South Central Los Angeles district was laid waste by the devastating riots of 1992, arsonists and looters destroying the livelihoods of thousands of her constituents, a great many of them Korean, her first instinct was to defend the criminals, saying the rioters were part of a rebellion. As for the drug epidemic in urban America, Waters focuses on the notion, exposed as a hoax by reports in the Washington Post, L.A. Times, and New York Times, among many others, that the CIA created the problem by promoting drug use in the inner cities. All of which would be easy to write off as the ravings of a fringe crank, except for one thing. Maxine Waters holds quite a bit of power and influence in her party, and these days, it's almost impossible to find a Democrat in Washington willing to cross her on any issue that involves race. One who dared, Joseph Lieberman, found out just how unpleasant that experience can be. When Lieberman, who had expressed reservations about affirmative action and who gave tentative support to school vouchers, was nominated for vice president by the Democrats in 2000, Waters caused a huge stink, demanding to know why she hadn't been consulted in advance and forcing him to appear before a black audience to explain himself. The explanation soon became a recantation, as Lieberman disowned the very moderate positions that might have gotten Al Gore and him elected. She is one of the most self-serving, hate-filled, race-obsessed politicians in America, as columnist Michelle Malkin puts it, and the Democratic Party doesn't just embrace her, it kneels at her feet. 46. Barbara Walters. If you go to the ABC News website, you will learn that Barbara Walters is one of the most highly acclaimed journalists on television. You will be told that she has interviewed every American president and first lady since Richard Nixon. You will be reminded that she made journalism history by arranging the first joint interview with Egypt's President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in November 1977. You will be informed that another of her firsts was an hour-long primetime conversation with Cuban President Fidel Castro, an interview which has been printed in half a dozen languages and shown all over the world. The fact is, Barbara Walters has probably interviewed more movers and shakers than anybody else in the world of broadcast journalism. Still, the ABC News website doesn't even begin to capture her real significance in American life, because it doesn't explain how Barbara Walters, more than anyone else, has helped turn serious television journalism into trivial crap. Indeed, In a refined, ladylike way, she has done more harm to journalism than did Jason Blair, the New York Times reporter who was exposed as a fraud and a plagiarist. And as Eric Bollert succinctly put it in a piece for Salon, Barbara Walters has long pioneered the transformation of television news into literally parlor gossip. Who, after all, he asks, better represents the watering down of television news than Barbara Walters? If it weren't a rhetorical question, the answer would be no one. It's not just that her questions are so puffball soft that she makes Larry King look like Bill O'Reilly, although that's part of it. I mean, who will ever forget her riveting, insightful query to Katharine Hepburn, "If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?" And when she interviewed rocker Courtney Love, and Miss Love told her, "You wouldn't be talking to me now if we actually sucked. We don't suck." A brilliant observation, of course, which prompted this equally brilliant follow-up from Barbara. What's the opposite of not sucking? Gilda Radner doing Baba Wawa on Saturday Night Live couldn't have made this stuff up. But Barbara Walters cannot be dismissed simply because she's gone into semi-retirement and has, over the years, become so silly. She's done way too much harm to get off that easy. As Neil Gabler explains in his book Hollywood Interrupted, Walters had managed to smuggle celebrity past the journalistic guard dogs and into a network news organization without making the distinction that Ed Murrow had made between his serious reportage and person-to-person. Still, Barbara Walters, the pioneer who became a role model for so many others who shamelessly turned celebrity fluff into serious reportage, never hesitated to play St. Barbara, martyr for journalistic integrity, when that suited her purposes. Back in 2001, when ABC News shuffled its primetime lineup, Barbara's show 2020 was temporarily moved out of its Friday night time slot, where it had been a fixture for 14 years. There were lots of news stories about how angry she was, about how hurt she was, about the tears, and even about the possibility that she might leave ABC over a temporary time slot change. She even went on her other show, The View, and sounding like the serious journalist she probably believes she is, Barbara said, "So many of us felt that news is a public trust and should be respected as such, and the perception was that ABC doesn't care about news." It was all too much for Eric Bollert, who wrote, "Have any of these commentators, including Dan Rather and Katie Couric, who have rushed to Walters' defense, watched 2020 lately? Has television news as a profession sunk so low that a show, when not investigating the poor sanitation conditions at a discount nail salon or airing interviews with Macaulay Culkin, can suddenly be regarded as a paragon of hard news reporting?" In the end, of course, it was no big deal. 2020 went back to its usual time slot, and Barbara Walters went back to doing what she does best, asking Leonardo DiCaprio if he has a girlfriend and grilling actress Anne Heche about her sex life with Ellen DeGeneres. But a question lingers, one that for all its apparent silliness really is important. If Barbara Walters were a tree, wouldn't television journalism be a lot better off? 45. Ken Lay. Ken Lay was Enron's chairman and CEO who claimed he had no idea other top executives of Enron were cooking the books and driving the company into bankruptcy right under his nose. Some statistics. Value of Enron stock Lay reportedly sold from 1996 to 2001. $184 million. Amount Ken Lay received in bonuses from 1997 to 2000, $18.1 million. Amount of severance check to each employee laid off since bankruptcy, a maximum of $13,500. Number of Enron employees, mid-2001, 20,600. Number of Enron employees today, zero. 44. Dennis Kozlowski. In June 2001, Dennis Kozlowski, then the CEO of Tyco, the giant conglomerate that was worth more than Ford and General Motors combined, threw a 40th birthday party for his wife. He invited about 75 people, hired a band, and had the whole thing videotaped. It was a nice little birthday party, and a good time was had by all. Oh, did I mention that the party was in Sardinia off the coast of Italy, or that Kozlowski flew the whole gang in for the party, or that they stayed at the super ritzy Cala di Volpe resort, where some rooms go for over $1,000 a night, or that hot models, male and female, were brought in to run around in togas to give the party an erotic bacchanalian flavor, or that the band he hired was Jimmy Buffett's band that played for 45 minutes and cost $250,000, or that there was an ice replica of Michelangelo's David that had vodka pouring out of his penis. Gee, I wonder why the very name Dennis Kozlowski has become shorthand for wretched excess and shameless greed. 3 years and 3 months after the birthday bash, Kozlowski was at a different get-together. This one was in a Manhattan courtroom, where, along with his chief financial officer, Kozlowski was on trial for allegedly looting Tyco of about $600 million by taking unauthorized bonuses and loans from the company and by getting Tyco to pick up the tab for unauthorized personal expenses. Like what allegedly unauthorized personal expenses? Well, there was the $15,000 19th-century French umbrella stand in the shape of a poodle, the $6,300 sewing basket, the $17,100 18th-century Venetian traveling toilet box, the $2,200 waste basket, the $2,900 coat hangers, the $5,900 bed sheets, two sets, the $1,650 appointment book, and the $445 pincushion. According to prosecutors, there was also the $100 million in loans to dozens of other executives and employees, which were later forgiven. And there were the allegations that Kozlowski borrowed about $30 million to buy property and build a house in Boca Raton, Florida, and about $7 million to buy a Park Avenue apartment in New York City, and millions more for other real estate transactions and luxury purchases. According to Dennis Kozlowski, it was all 100% legal. And who knows, he may even be right. That trial ended in a mistrial. A second trial was underway in the spring of 2005. But this is not about the trials, past or future. It's not about legalese at all. No, it's about a man who thought he was Marie Antoinette, living like there was no tomorrow while his company was gobbling up lots of other smaller companies, then streamlining the new bigger Tyco conglomerate by shutting down dozens of plants and firing thousands of employees. In the end, it's about greed and shame, and about a man who was able to rise to the very heights of success, apparently without even knowing what those words mean. 43. Paul Eibler. You're walking down the street and you see a great-looking car stopped at a red light. You want it. So you rip open the door, throw the driver onto the street, and take it. Later in the day, you see someone you don't like, so you stomp him into the ground. Now the cops have you cornered. No biggie. Just pull out your semi-automatic and blow them all away. After that, just for fun, you can massacre lots of other people who get in your way with your sniper rifle or your chainsaw, or hey, if you're in the mood, you can just set them on fire. Welcome to the vile world of depravity, also known as Grand Theft Auto, one of the most popular video games on the market, a game that has sold 35 million copies with sales worldwide worth about $2 billion. It's not for nothing that Grand Theft Auto has been called a cop-killing game and a murder simulator. In one scenario, the player walks into a police station, breaks a convict out of jail, and escapes by shooting a bunch of cops. Should there be a law against this kind of thing? Probably not. Censorship tends to lead to more censorship, which makes it a dangerous road to travel. But should we feel revulsion at this moral garbage that big-time video game manufacturers are peddling to kids, though nominally they can't sell it to anyone under 17? Damn right we should, And while we're at it, here's another question that begs to be asked. Does everything always have to be about money? Don't get me wrong, I'm all for capitalism, and yes, I get it. Businesses are about the bottom line. Fine. So let's see. Would that make it okay if they made a game where players rape make-believe women, or kill computer-generated gays, or blacks, or even dogs? Yet these guys shamelessly go ahead and push a game where it's okay to kill computer-generated cops? No one disputes that for a certain kind of person, video game mayhem and the murder of virtual cops is a compelling experience. Just as $2 billion in worldwide sales is a compelling experience for Paul Eibeler. But a lot of Americans, all that money notwithstanding, still don't get it. One of them, a Methodist minister from Alabama named Steve Strickland, told Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes, "The question I have to ask the manufacturers is, why do you make games that target people who are there to protect us, police officers, people that we look up to? Why do you want to market a game that gives people even the thoughts that it's okay to shoot police officers? Why do you want to do that?" As it happens, the reason 60 Minutes was doing a story about Grand Theft Auto is that Take-Two Interactive, the company that makes the game, now finds itself in the crosshairs, the target of a multi-million-dollar lawsuit charging the game provoked an act of horrible violence against police. This is called irony, or in some circles, sticking it to the SOBs. The civil suit was filed against the makers and marketers of Grand Theft Auto on behalf of three men in Alabama, two of them police officers who were shot and killed by an 18-year-old who had been picked up on suspicion of, you got it, auto theft, and who decided to shoot his way out of trouble. He had no prior police record, but said he had been playing Grand Theft Auto day and night for a month before the shooting. "Life is like a video game," he reportedly told police after his capture. "Everybody's got to die sometime." No matter what a jury ultimately decides on whether the people who make Grand Theft Auto can be held legally responsible for the killings, the wrenching questions posed by Methodist minister Steve Strickland about why anyone would want to make a game that targets the people who protect us ought to cause sleepless nights for Paul Eibeler and anyone else at his company. Because when Strickland poignantly asks, "Why do you want to do that?" it's not just rhetorical. His brother Arnold was one of the murdered policemen. 42. Gloria Steinem. Let's say you're a guy who runs a big, important company, and a woman who has supported your causes in the past comes in to see you about a job, which she says she desperately needs because her husband, who eventually kills himself, is out of work and the family needs money to get out of debt. You find her attractive, so without asking, you fondle her breast. She pushes your hand away, and you figure nothing ventured, nothing gained. You gave it a shot. It didn't pan out. No big deal. Now let's say that years earlier, when you were the top dog in a much smaller company, you did pretty much the same thing. This time, you're walking through a local hotel where your company is running a big function, and you spot a woman who works for you. Through an intermediary, you send word that you want her to come up to your room. Since you're the boss, she complies, though she's a bit confused because she's just a low-level employee. In the room, you sit and you talk for a while, and then you casually pull your pecker out of your pants and make a suggestion regarding what the young woman might want to do with it. She says no thanks, gets up, and rushes out of the room. Hey, no harm, no foul, right? You didn't force either of the women to do anything. As a powerful male, you made an honest effort to get some nookie in the workplace with a powerless woman. So, it sure isn't sexual harassment, that much we're sure of. And why exactly are we so sure? Well, because Gloria Steinem herself, one of, if not the best-known feminist of our time, has told us it isn't sexual harassment. Except Miss Steinem wasn't talking about the president of some hypothetical company who was accused of sexual hanky-panky. She was talking about the president of the United States. She was writing in a New York Times op-ed, no less, about President Clinton, who was accused of playing grab-ass with Kathleen Willey in the Oval Office and of unzipping his pants in a Little Rock hotel room in front of Paula Jones. The truth is, Ms. Steinem wrote on March 22, 1998, that even if the allegations are true, the president is not guilty of sexual harassment. He is accused of having made a gross, dumb, and reckless pass at a supporter, Miss Willey, during a low point in her life. She pushed him away, she said, and it never happened again. In other words, President Clinton took no for an answer. In other words, are you kidding? Thanks to Gloria Steinem, every guy in America, and hey, let's be equality-minded here, every woman too, now has the right to cop one free feel no matter how gross, dumb, and reckless that pass might be. And thanks to Gloria Steinem and a few others like her, feminism in America is dead. For years, feminism has been accused of rank hypocrisy, of savaging perceived enemies and giving friends a pass, of twisting facts to suit the feminist agenda. And now, in one fell, idiotic swoop, Gloria Steinem showed the world that it was all true. There's a name for what Gloria Steinem did. It's called selling out your principles. And she did it without any pressure, without anyone holding a gun to her head, simply because Bill Clinton was a Democrat who was on her side of issues important to feminists, like abortion. And for that, Ms. Steinem became an apologist for the abuse of power. There's a name for that, too, especially when you've ostensibly devoted your life to making sure that women don't get run over by powerful men. It's called hypocrisy. 41. Susan Beresford. Follow the money. It was good advice back in the days of Watergate, and it still is today. Let's say there's some radical group out there throwing its weight around. Follow the money, and you'll find a sugar daddy behind the curtain writing big fat checks, or some foundation. Most people by now know, for example, that George Soros is the money bags behind all sorts of left-wing political groups. But even though he spends millions, he's a bit player compared to the giant foundations with names like Rockefeller, MacArthur, and especially Ford. The Ford Foundation, led by its president Susan Beresford, has become a great big piggy bank for an amazing range of organizations pushing left-wing agendas. It's practically a shadow government with its own domestic policy, its own foreign policy, and assets put at about $11 billion, which makes the Ford Foundation wealthier than a lot of small countries. And what does Ford do with its money? Most Americans don't have a clue. Most, for example, probably think the Ford Foundation, if they think about it at all, is part of the car company. It once was, but today it's totally independent, with roughly $1 billion to hand out every year. Compare that to the measly $25 million Soros gave away to anti-Bush activists in 2004, and you start to understand how big and how powerful Ford and Beresford are. Beresford is a child of the radical 60s. She graduated from Radcliffe in 1965, and she's got enough money at her disposal to at least try to create a brave new world in her own image. At Ford, she has vigorously pushed a whole bunch of noble-sounding leftist programs, focusing, she proclaims, on racism, sexism, the environment, peace and justice, among others. Who's not against racism and for peace and justice, right? But follow the money, and it'll lead you right to the heavy hand of liberal PC. As former Treasury Secretary William Simon says, under the rubric of the public interest, Ford is engaged in a radical assault on traditional culture. Let us count the ways. Under Beresford, Ford has made the nation's colleges and universities a particular target, pushing radical feminism and multiculturalism and every other strain of fashionable left-wing political activism on campus. You say your school wants money from Ford. Then you have to toe its rigid line on diversity, which mandates that every grant application include a diversity table, spelling out for the Ford bean counters the number of non-whites and women that will be involved in the project. Ford also doled out money for racial justice litigation, advocacy, and educational outreach activities related to the detention and racial profiling of Arab Americans and Muslims following the World Trade Center attack, and used it to file suits against the detention of captured terrorists at Guantanamo. Ford has also been a longtime banker for anti-Semitic hate groups, like the Jerusalem-based Society of St. Eve's and the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and the Environment, the latter an organizer of the notorious 2002 United Nations Conference on Racism in Durban, South Africa, that became a festival of vicious Israel bashing. In perhaps its most blatantly arrogant display of contempt for the popular will, Ford has for years been at the forefront of the fight to throw open America's borders, donating more than $60 million to the cause. As Dan Stein, executive director of the Federation for Immigration Reform, explained it on the Bill O'Reilly program, Ford's objective is nothing less than to radically overhaul the ethnic basis of American society. Yes, O'Reilly cut in, as if the whole crazy idea wasn't computing, but they're white. They're white rich people. Yes, they are, Stein replied, white rich people with a paternal, elitist, leftist liberalism. And they have the money to make their dreams come true. 40. Scott Harshberger. Sexual abuse of children is a real and terrible problem, one that for too long was swept under the rug. But back in the 80s, when the issue provoked a nationwide wave of hysteria, there were other innocent victims. Child care workers themselves, decent people from Massachusetts to California, and lots of places in between, were charged on the basis of outlandish stories and the total absence of any physical evidence with having committed horrendous crimes against children. Believe the children became the mantra. Children don't lie about such things, we heard over and over again. They don't make this stuff up. And too many prosecutors, for all sorts of reasons, were willing to believe anything the children said, no matter how bizarre the allegation, and no matter how much the children were coaxed into saying things even they didn't believe happened. There were many overzealous, politically ambitious prosecutors behind these cases, prosecutorial zealots, in the words of the Wall Street Journal's Dorothy Rabinowitz, who won a Pulitzer for her investigative reports on child abuse cases. They were, she said, runaway prosecutors who quite simply, in many cases, don't care if you're guilty or if you're not guilty. But none was more zealous or even now remained so unrepentant as Scott Harshberger. Harshberger was the district attorney of Middlesex County, Massachusetts, not far from Salem, Massachusetts, where during another wave of hysteria, they burned witches based on other outlandish stories. In 1984, Harshberger launched his prosecution of the Amaralt family, which ran a daycare center called Fells Acres in the town of Malden. The case started with a 5-year-old boy claiming that his pants were pulled down, and as in the case of the McMartin preschool in California, which had broken just a few months before, the charges rapidly snowballed, becoming increasingly grotesque and bizarre. After questioning by social workers and police, the children began saying they had been fondled, violated, and photographed at nude swimming parties and taken to a magic room by a bad clown, and finally that they'd been forced to eat human feces and attacked with knives. There was no physical evidence to support any of it, and though the daycare center was open, with parents and other adults coming in and out all the time, no one had ever seen anything to support any of the charges. But none of that gave Harshberger the slightest pause. With everything he had, Harshberger went after the Amaralts. 61-year-old Violet, who ran the center, her son Gerald, and her daughter Cheryl Lefebvre, who also worked there. Solely on the basis of the children's stories, including one 4-year-old's claim that Violet Amaralt inserted a 4.5-inch butcher knife into his anus without leaving a mark. They were convicted of sexually abusing some 40 children. Gerald got 40 years in prison, his mother and sister up to 20 years. Never mind that there were tapes of the interviews between the prosecutors and the children, which revealed how the interrogators had been complicit from the outset in shaping the children's incredible testimony. As Dorothy Rabinowitz noted, the children were making the stories up because the interrogators were saying, "If you don't help me and tell me, we're going to be so disappointed. You're going to betray your little friends." And yet, none of the jurors ever saw this testimony. These were some really egregious interviewing techniques. I was very disturbed, is how an expert hired by 2020 to review the tapes put it. The child is repeatedly saying no. I can't even count how many times this child said no, and how many times the question was re-asked and redirected, and the child's answers were seemingly not sufficient. While in other cases, including McMartin, such revelations led to acquittals or had convictions overturned on appeal, Massachusetts prosecutors, led by Harshbarger, continued to fight for nearly two decades to keep the Amaralts behind bars. One judge, throwing out the convictions of the women after a review of the evidence, declared it would be improper for them to spend even 1 minute more in prison. You'd think all of this would have been enough for Scott Harshbarger to simply and finally let it go. And you'd be wrong. By now, he was the Attorney General of Massachusetts, and in that position, as the chief legal officer of the state, he further dug in his heels and appealed the cases. He told the Boston Globe, "The Amaralts are right where serious child abusers ought to be." And in response to Rabinowitz's stories in the Wall Street Journal, he wrote to the paper comparing the Amaralts to child murderers Joel Steinberg and John Wayne Gacy. There's a far better comparison to be made, and that is between Harshbarger himself and Inspector Javert, the pathologically obsessed officer of the law in Les Miserables, who doggedly pursues a good and decent man for stealing a crust of bread for a hungry child, and after he captures him, locks him up for 19 years. At least Jean Valjean, the thief, was guilty of something. The Amaralts didn't do anything. As the Boston Globe's Ed Siegel wrote after watching 2020's story on the Amaralt case, "There will be a number of people who might ask Harshbarger and his associates, Riley and Dolan, 'Have you no decency? At long last, have you no sense of decency?'" It is likely such a question would be completely lost on Harshbarger, who seems never to have had a doubt about anything he's ever done. After his tenure as Attorney General and failing in a run for governor, he became head of Common Cause, the liberal activist group. As for the Amaralts, by the time Violet and her daughter were released in 1995, Violet, at age 72, was the oldest female inmate in state prison. Her son Gerald was not paroled until 2003. According to the Boston Globe, former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger, the Middlesex District Attorney, when the case was prosecuted, called the decision to release Amaralt unfortunate. He was concerned, he said, that the parole decision not be seen as an exoneration of Amaralt. Violet, the mother, died 2 years after she was released. Near Amaralt's bed at home, the Globe reported, a photograph of a sign harshly critical of her nemesis, Attorney General Scott Harshbarger, provided her comfort, family members said. 39. Peter Singer. The New Yorker magazine has called Peter Singer among the most influential philosophers around. But who is it exactly that Peter Singer, Princeton University's Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics, influences? Well, other academics, of course, that goes without saying, and the mainstream media, which is constantly airing his views on many of today's thorny, emotionally wrenching issues involving bioethics, medical care, and the meaning of a properly lived life. He's gotten over 100 mentions in the New York Times alone. I understand that your first instinct may be to say, "Hey, the guy's a philosopher, for heaven's sake. Lighten up. He sits up there in his ivory tower and gazes at his navel." But that would be a big mistake, especially if Peter Singer ever got his way. You see, Peter Singer calls himself a utilitarian philosopher. He makes no secret that his aim is to change the way we look at the world, the very way we live our lives. And he uses philosophy and ethics to justify behavior that has gotten him labeled as the most reviled philosopher in the world. Fair? You decide. The Australian-born Singer, who has been called the godfather of animal rights, first made a splash back in 1975, when he was just 29 years old, with the publication of Animal Liberation, the book he himself proudly calls the seminal work of that movement. Singer wasn't merely interested in stopping cruelty to animals. He was concerned with something far more ambitious. As he asked in another book, In Defense of Animals, why do we experiment with chimps, yet would never think of doing the same to a retarded human being at a much lower mental level? The only possible answer, he said, is that the chimpanzee, no matter how bright, is not human, while the retarded human, no matter how dull, is. In fact, he said, in our behavior, we should recognize no distinctions between humans and animals. In fairness, I think we have to acknowledge that Singer has raised a provocative question. Why is it okay to cut into the head of a very smart chimp to explore his brain, and yet we consider it immoral to do the same with a human, no matter how slow he may be? Peter Singer is no dummy, but he flatly rejects the basic tenet of Judeo-Christian thought that human life is special, that humans are not comparable to chimps or rats or pigs. When Singer made his chimpanzee versus retarded human argument, he was only warming up. His next area of concern, a natural outgrowth of how he sees certain mentally and physically impaired human beings, was euthanasia. But unlike others who support it, Singer sees it as useful not only for the terminally ill or for the infirmed elderly. As he wrote in his book, Practical Ethics, killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often, it is not wrong at all. Quite simple, as Reason magazine observes, fetuses and some very impaired human beings are not persons in his view, and have a lesser moral status than, say, adult gorillas and chimpanzees. And as Singer told an animal rights conference, repeating a position he had put forth before, and one that tells you everything you need to know about him, society should allow a severely disabled infant to be killed up to 28 days after its birth if the parents decide the baby's life is not worth living. Think of it as a lemon law for certain kinds of defective babies. Our hearts go out to parents whose babies are born with severe disabilities. Still, it's a good thing that FDR wasn't born with polio, or that Helen Keller wasn't born deaf, dumb, and blind, because if they were, in Peter Singer's world, they might never have made it out of the hospital. And what might happen if Singer had his way and parents decide they don't want a baby with some other disability? Would it be okay to kill an infant with Down syndrome? How about one with deformed arms or legs? There's a reason they call it a slippery slope. Fears about where it all might lead prompted one disabled rights activist to say that Singer is the most dangerous man in the world today, just the kind of review that makes you a superstar in the world of the Academy. Still, when Princeton appointed him to his highly prestigious post in 1999, in ethics, remember, it did arouse protest, with some students arguing that it was morally repugnant to offer him such an important stage to promote the killing of disabled babies. There were other protests against him when he lectured in Germany, where they know something about taking human life lightly. It was widely claimed that the policies Singer was pushing were identical to some of those pushed by Hitler before World War II as mercy killing. What made it truly ironic was that the lesson seemed to have been lost on Singer, whose own parents fled Nazi Germany in the 30s and whose grandparents died in concentration camps. Yet in this country, his stature has continued to grow, He has now written more than 24 books, giving his ethical views on a range of subjects. His most recent, published in 2004, is a Bush-bashing work titled The President of Good and Evil, The Ethics of George W. Bush, in which he slams W. on everything from tax policy to his position on stem cell research. But really, the book is basically just standard-issue liberal politics, so much less offensive and important than much of the other stuff he's done. The real story of the damage Peter Singer continues to impose on civilized culture is found in the petition circulated by those Princeton students who stood up to protest his hiring by a university that was once a bastion of Western thought and culture. We protest his hiring because Dr. Singer denies the intrinsic moral worth of an entire class of human beings, newborn children, and promotes policies that would deprive many infants with disabilities of their basic human right to legal protection against homicide. 38. Jim McDermott. It's one thing to be against the war in Iraq, but it's something else for a United States congressman to stand in Baghdad right before our troops put their lives on the line and tell the world that Saddam Hussein can be trusted, but the President of the United States can't. Yet that's what Congressman Jim McDermott did. McDermott, who was a far-left winger and leading member of the Blame America First contingent of the Democratic Party, represents a part of Seattle that is not only ground zero for ridiculously overpriced coffee and ridiculously overheated anti-capitalist rhetoric, but is also, with the possible exception of Berkeley and a few square miles of Beverly Hills and Malibu, the home of more progressive loonies than any place on the left coast. So McDermott fits right in. McDermott makes all the usual noises for all the usual reasons. He vigorously opposed all attempts to curtail partial birth abortions. He refused to speak the words "under God" when reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in the House. He said the Patriot Act trampled our cherished civil liberties. But then he went to Baghdad and stepped way over the line. On the very eve of the war with Iraq, along with now former Congressman David Bonnier, McDermott consorted with Ba'athist murderers and allowed himself to be used by Saddam's propagandists. Attacking the president's credibility in Seattle may not be a big deal, something lots of folks do while sipping their grande lattes and mocha frappuccinos, but to do it in Baghdad when he did was treacherous. McDermott's Baghdad performance was so bad that even Democratic National Committee Chairman Terry McAuliffe, who'd earned his stripes defending his pal Bill Clinton, couldn't find a way to put an acceptable face on it. This is very rare for McAuliffe, who usually gets behind anybody or anything that suggests George Bush is a liar. This time, with McDermott, he sheepishly dodged all questions on the subject. But not to worry. The congressman does have his defenders and devoted admirers. One of them even called McDermott his highly respected friend and a man of honor and integrity. In case you're interested, the devoted admirer was Fidel Castro. 37. Al Franken. Al Franken says he's a satirist, by which he means he can say nasty things about anyone he wants and then claim it's all in good fun. Small world. I'm a satirist, too. Not long ago, I sat down with Al Franken for a one-on-one interview about his life and career. We spoke, appropriately enough, in his radio studio in New York City, where he hosts the Al Franken Show on Air America, which is a liberal talk radio network that is carried in several cities. This is the interview. Goldberg. Hi, Al, and thanks for letting me come in and have this chat with you today. Franken, you're a liar. What do you mean I'm a liar? I never said you were a liar, Bernie, you liar. You're telling lies, Bernie, about me lying about you lying. That's a lie. Okay, Al, but before we actually begin, I need to apologize. For what? Well, Al, for listing you all the way down at number 37. When I started this project, before you went on the air here at Air America, I had you in the top five of all the people who are screwing up America. But I'm afraid that after the presidential election, when it became clear that lefties like you probably hurt Kerry more than they helped him, and that you were becoming more and more irrelevant politically, I had to drop you all the way down to 37. And if we did this interview next week, Al, you might be number 73. Bernie, you're a big fat idiot. Excuse me, Al? Liar. Okay, Al, someone once said that liberals have forgotten how to be liberal, meaning they're no longer open-minded. They think that the other side is not just wrong, but morally repugnant. Any thoughts, Al? Yes, Bernie. I think you're a big fat idiot. You just said that, Al. No, I didn't. Okay, let's move on. You've had quite a career, Saturday Night Live, movies, politics, and now your own radio show. What motivates you? Well, Bernie, as I'm sure you know, I'm good enough, smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. That's what motivates me, knowing how good enough and smart enough I am. And I think if you send off positive vibes, as I do, people will like you, which is why they like me. I also have lots of self-esteem, which is good. And most of all, I'm not negative. Okay, Al, what do you think of conservatives? I think they're a bunch of motherfucking Nazi assholes who should drink poison and die. Al, how does angry talk like that, which we hear a lot from liberals these days, jibe with your insistence that you're not negative? I don't get it. That's because you, Bernie, didn't go to Harvard. And I did. Harvard is where smart people go to college. I went there. All right, Al, that leads me to my next question. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Okay, Al, so here's what I'm wondering. You went to Harvard. Frank Rich, the New York Times columnist, went to Harvard. Michael Kinsley, now of the LA Times, went to Harvard. You're all very smart, but you're all very nasty also. Why are so many Harvard media guys so mean-spirited? Come on, Bernie, you really need to ask that question? Just look at the three of us. We're proof that evolution is only a theory. I mean, Frank and I are always goofing on Kinsley, behind his back, of course. The guy makes Richard Simmons look like Sylvester Stallone. He's always nitpicking because somebody used a semicolon instead of a comma. This guy is a loser. So is Frank, but don't tell him I told you. That's quite revealing, Al. Anything else? Yes, I'm going to tell you a secret, Bernie, because I like you. We all hate ourselves. Frank Rich, Michael Kinsley, and me, we're self-loathing nerds who can't do much except make fun of other people. Why do you think I call people liars? Because it makes me feel better about me. Bernie, I'm so sick. I've never heard you open up like this, Al. Do you really think that you're sick? Who said that, Bernie? You did. You just told me exactly that, Al. Have I called you a liar yet today? Because if I haven't, I'm about to start, Bernie. Al, let me ask you another question. Why are you wearing a tinfoil hat? No comment. Okay, Al. Thanks very much for your time. Oh, by the way, do you know why you're number 37 on the list of people who are screwing up America? No, actually, I don't, Bernie. Well, you know who Casey Stengel was, right, Al? Sure, that baseball man, right? Right, Al, that baseball man. He was the manager of the New York Yankees. Well, Casey walked into spring training one year and told all his players to line up in alphabetical order according to height. He wasn't trying to be funny. Casey spoke gibberish, gobbledygook, total nonsense, just like you, Al. And Casey's uniform number was 37. That's why I gave you that number. Do you like my hat, Bernie? It's made out of tinfoil, you know. Thanks again, Al. Liar. Thirty-six. Nancy Hopkins. I don't know about you, but I'm tired of listening to left-wing feminists complain about how tough they have.